Good morning, Glenn. Be seated. Okay, the first matter we have on calendar this morning is docket number 64987, Pers versus Harper. Mr. Byers, are we ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Please the court. My name is Philip Burns. I'm with the Las Vegas City Attorney's Office. I'm representing the City of Las Vegas in this matter. If possible, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
At the conclusion. This case involves retirement for public employees, and the ultimate facts are relatively simple. The City of Las Vegas has many employees, including a number of firefighters. We make PERS contributions on their behalf for their retirement. In about 2007, PERS commenced an audit of the city regarding our contributions. They found some anomalies that indicated over-reporting, so they engaged in an extended audit. They ultimately found that we had overpaid in several instances on a number of firefighters, mainly misclassifying overtime. The PERS instructed us to go back, redo the reports for the firefighters to correct the overpayments, and instructed us to commence with either persons who had just recently retired or who were about to retire. The persons who would be most affected by the overpayments. As to three of the plaintiffs, they'd already retired. We submitted new returns on them. PERS essentially did a clawback where they recovered some benefits that had already been paid and reduced benefits going forward. Now, there are a number of things in this matter that are undisputed. Public employee benefits are strictly a creation of the legislature. The city has no opportunity to alter benefits by contract or other agreement. The legislature determines what each employee will get. There's no dispute that the city overpaid the benefits, at least as under PERS interpretation of the statutes, which we don't contest. And also, no one at the city ever provided any benefits, benefit estimates, or retirement advice, or anything to any of the plaintiffs.
Wait, say that again, Mr. Burns. I missed that. I thought several of the plaintiffs were personally counseled. I think I misheard what you said.
They weren't counseled by individuals with the city. They were counseled by PERS.
Okay.
No, it's every plaintiff testified that nobody at the city ever gave them benefit estimate or advise them on how to structure their retirement.
PERS did.
That was all PERS.
Okay.
Well, but the basis of PERS advice are your erroneous reports.
Oh,
at the root of this case, and I'm going to ask all counsel to comment on this, if the facts are the city erroneously calculates the retirement benefits, then how does that impact the decision made by an employee who makes a premature retirement decision based upon those errors? Is there liability?
Okay. There are several aspects to that question, Your Honor. One, the city doesn't calculate retirement benefits. We make calculations going forward as to current wages.
Let's assume, for purposes of my statement, that the calculations you make go into the calculations of retirement.
There's no dispute of that.
Okay, so let's start.
PERS made their estimate based on the contributions that we made.
And you reported those as pensionable pay, right? I mean, so the mistake was on the city.
The mistake as to the amounts were on the city.
Yeah.
Okay. Now,
so at the root of this case, where there are erroneous calculations made and an employee makes a retirement decision based upon those errors, is there liability for PERS or for you?
I'm not going to argue on behalf of PERS, but as to the city, I don't believe there will be.
Why not?
We were found liable on one theory, negligent misrepresentation. And I would submit that as a matter of law, negligent misrepresentation can't apply in this case.
Why not?
In the 1970s, the court in the Stemmel Motors case adopted Section 552 of the Restatement of Torts to define what constitutes negligent misrepresentation. Negligent misrepresentation is much more limited than fraud or intentional deceit. There's no issue at all here whether the city was intentionally trying to deceive these employees. It was a simple mistake. But it only applies for someone who supplies false information for the guidance of others in their business transactions. The court has consistently held that that applies if you're dealing with business or commercial transactions. And in this case, this is a simple employment relationship. And if you compare a couple of the cases the court's decided in the past, in the Stemmel case, the representation was relied on by a bank that made a commercial bank that made a secured loan on bad security. It was clearly information that was used in the course of a business or commercial transaction. If you compare that to the Bartmettler versus Reno Air case, where the representation was about an employee benefit, in that case, the confidentiality of a drug program, and the court found that the conduct did not fit squarely within a business or commercial transaction. This is a simple employment relationship. It's not like the city does engage in some transactions that could fall within the negligent misrepresentation. If we're making disclosures on a bond issue, that's intended to be relied on to make investment decisions, business or commercial transactions. Here, this is a simple employment situation. It's much more like Bartmettler.
Does the last sentence in NRS 286-288, though, leave the door open for the possibility of liability on the part of the city when there are inaccurate or misleading pieces of information supplied to the employee? You may not have it in front of you, but the sentence reads, the system, referring to PERS, is responsible for any inaccurate or misleading information provided to any person or agency by an officer or employee of the system, but is not responsible for inaccurate or misleading information provided an officer or employee of a participating public employer or any other person. Does the second portion of that sentence leave open the possibility that liability could exist for a city in these circumstances?
That language doesn't create any liability for the city or any other public employer. It more allocates responsibility between PERS and the employers. I think there'd have to be another basis for liability to impose liability on the employer or to the employee. That allocates responsibility between PERS and the employers. And the legislature has, going forward, taken care of that by saying the employers are liable for the damages resulting from erroneous contributions, but that statute wasn't adopted until long after the facts in this case.
What happens with the over-contribution by you to PERS? In other words, you reported as pensionable benefits something that wasn't pensionable, so presumably you made a contribution to the PERS system associated with that. I saw the number, I think. Does that get paid back to you, or how is that done?
The contributions, as we submitted the amended returns, were refunded to the city.
To the city.
Yes.
So, and then this, so by logic, it would seem, you could read 286-460 subparent 7 to be a recognition of a claim by the employee against the city in that instance where the mistake fell at the city's feet. Could you not?
A claim for the somehow to receive the erroneous contributions?
Mm-hmm.
The erroneous contributions are much less than the benefits going forward.
Right.
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but it's only like between $80,000 and $100,000 for all four of the plaintiffs.
Right, and that brings me to another question on the damage calculation. Did anyone explore at trial in this case the idea that the claim for reliance was on something that was statutorily impossible? Because if the legislature said overtime is not pensionable, and the highest value years were inflated by the impermissible inclusion of overtime, how is it that an employee could ever have had a legitimate claim to that higher figure as a statutory matter? And so I was puzzling over how they even got to the damage claim.
The damage claims are very fuzzy in this case. There's actually two aspects to the question. We had argued that both PERS and the city have argued that the legislature determines the benefits. They're not entitled to anything more than what the legislature accounted for, which is essentially.
Although you have the Byrne case, not named after you, but that's a problem for you on that.
I know the. There's another issue in this case is. You can't assume that all four plaintiffs justifiably relied on the benefit estimates. The evidence really shows possibly one of the four. As to Mr. Pulsifer, he testified that he received an estimate he could have worked longer, and he determined to retire instead of going for his full 36 years. The other three plaintiffs all had very different situations. Chief Harper died without being deposed. There was no testimony whatsoever on his thought process other than some speculation from his widow. Mr. Breen was in another different situation. He'd had a stroke back in 2004. He could no longer work as a fireman. He was just running out his leave time, and he had decided he was going to run it up to 30 and then retire, but he could never go back to work, and he admitted that.
Chief, I just had a question. Is PERS dividing time with the city on this case?
Or? I didn't hear anything to that effect.
Okay.
He reserved 2 minutes.
Okay.
So I assume not.
Okay.
Evidently,
we the court contacted my staff, and we advised the court that we were splitting the 15 minutes between the city and PERS.
Okay, nobody brought that to my attention. Okay, I'll let you reserve the balance of your time.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you 5 minutes. I'm going to add 5 minutes to your time as well.
Thank you.
Okay, we weren't advised. Okay. I wasn't advised.
I'm sorry, I thought that was taken care of, Your Honor.
No. Thanks, Mark.
Chris Wicker, Woodman Wedge, appearing on behalf of the Public Employees Retirement System. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes if I could.
Well, you only got five, but.
Maybe I'll make that 1 minute in case I have something else to say. So these cases are always very difficult situations because you're dealing with frustrated expectations of an employee upon retirement. But in this case, this is not a case where the circumstances are such where PERS should be held liable.
And Mr. Wicker, that's actually my question. You know, it appears from the record that the mistake made was by the city in over-reporting the amount of compensable time, and therefore, how could PERS be liable if the city did this? I mean, PERS, I guess, relied initially on those calculations and did the audit and so on and so forth. So, I know with the Byrne case, I mean, PERS made representations to Mr. Byrne that he would get so much a month, you know, like, I mean, he retired as Mayor Henderson, and he relied upon that. But this case seems a little different to me. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts is that this is extremely different than the Byrne case. The court found PERS liable basically on two fact scenarios. One, that the counselors with only two of the plaintiffs, Mr. Pulsifer and Mr. Breen, allegedly told them that when the final numbers come in, their benefit retirements could only go up. And the other one is the fact that the PERS did not advise the retiring plaintiffs that there was an audit being conducted. And what I would say about those two fact scenarios, it's quite different from Byrne, because we're talking about, in Byrne, there was a written deliberative representation of retirement benefits. Since that time, PERS has made all of its benefit estimates. They've made them estimates, and they say they're estimates subject to final calculation. The letters all say they're subject to final calculation. And in this case, the liability is based on the alleged statement of two counselors saying that your benefits will only go up. That's a very dangerous road to go down for PERS, because if liability for damages or even lifetime benefits can be based on the plaintiff's claim that two counselors said their benefits would only go up, that PERS is practically defenseless for that sort of a claim, because counselors deal with thousands of people, and we can't bring a counselor into trial and say, I remember that conversation, and I didn't say that.
Well, what if you've got individuals who rely upon this information, they offer the counseling, and you've got these individuals relying on the information that they're getting to their detriment, ultimately, in these cases?
Well, the real reliance in this case was on the fact that PERS was provided inaccurate information from the city of Las Vegas, and that's what led to everything. And so PERS has to accept the information from the city of Las Vegas. They have to use that information to calculate benefits. Now, when it turns out they're wrong, by statute, PERS has to adjust the benefits to fit what the law says. In this case, PERS cannot pay benefits or take contributions on amounts that are not allowed by law. And so if I think the reliance would be misplaced on a comment by a counselor in a verbal situation where your benefits can only go up. And that was only two as to Pulsifer and Breen. And the court found PERS liable on the basis of negligent misrepresentation. And I would submit that those kinds of statements are either estimates or opinions that are not actionable under negligent misrepresentation. And I would also submit that, as a policy matter, a statement by a counselor, totally verbal, and I would note that Mr. Pulsifer and Mr. Breen wrote letters complaining about this right after they found out what their new benefits were, never mentioned that they had been counseled that the benefits would never go up. It was at trial where they said our benefits would only go up. And I would only add one last thing, Your Honor.
You want to reserve your time? Or?
Yes, I'd like.
Just wondering. Mr. Olson?
Eric Olson, appearing on behalf of the respondents. Let me start with addressing the city's position with respect to negligent misrepresentation, if it pleases the court. The city suggests that the decision being made by the firemen in this case was not a financial decision, it's just an employment decision. This was the ultimate financial decision for these folks. And they relied upon the representations made to them by PERS, but I think the court asked the question, you know, isn't the city responsible for that information being provided? It is indeed responsible. And the fact that the representations weren't made directly by a person at the city to the fireman, it is not the issue. The Epperson case, which we cited, says if you provide false information to someone who you know is going to provide it to someone else who's going to rely on it, in this case to PERS, for the benefit of the fireman, you can be liable for that. And that's what the city did. The city was in error. Now, of course, PERS knew this was an issue since the late 80s, and that's in the record. They also knew by the time the disclosures were being made by counselors and online to our clients, they knew that there was an audit underway for an initial audit.
Audit's underway all the time, correct?
But this audit, Your Honor, was targeted. The first audit in 2007 was targeted at the city. They determined there was an issue with the firemen. they ordered by December 2007 a targeted audit initially to be for the 2004-2008 period. In the end, they targeted just this group of people, just 2008 retirees. So they knew there was an issue. There's also a PERS.
So your theory is that they had a mandatory duty to report the ongoing audit or the discretionary duty?
They certainly had a mandatory duty. It was not discretionary to get to the issue of immunity. It was not a discretionary act. It was to offer an audit. It was not discretionary to choose not to disclose this information to beneficiaries. So I think as far as negligent misrepresentation, I don't...
Is that have extended to all people who were working and who had not yet retired? That mandatory duty?
If people were... at the time, as of December 2007, they knew that the target group was firemen at a certain point in their careers. So
that's a different question. Let's say that this mistake about callback and overtime and what was pensionable was made across a group of firemen, some of whom were fully retired, others of whom were in their preliminary retirement, others of whom had not yet retired, and others of whom were fairly early in their careers. I'm exploring your mandatory duty of alerting this group of employees to their obligation to of the mistake that the city had made. Who would get that notice and how, and where is it mandatory in the statute?
It's not mandatory in the statute in the sense that it calls for that kind of reporting, but what is the obligation of PERS is, as part of their fiduciary duty, to be forthright with their beneficiaries. They owe that duty. People certainly who are in the process of coming to them, contemplating retirement, and asking them, I need to make a decision, tell me what my retirement benefits are going to be, that's what we're focused on. Certainly those people are entitled to know, in making the decision, what their benefits are going to be, and if they may be impacted by an audit targeted at those benefits, they're entitled to know that.
But why doesn't 286, 288 insulate PERS from liability, even under your theory? How does that statute create liability under a duty to report the existence of an audit, the results of which they're not even clear about?
Well, first of all, it's the information, when you say to these people, and the counselor said in at least two instances, these are your benefits, and they can only go up from here.
Okay.
And this is true of the others who relied on estimates. If there's an audit ongoing, and that audit is targeted at ferreting out specifically callbacks, overpayments, it's misleading to not disclose that.
The statute specifically and interestingly uses both inaccurate and misleading information to provide a defense to PERS from liability. It specifically says they're not liable for inaccurate or misleading information. So how does one address the apparent defense created by this statute to the theory that they had some duty to inform of the existence of an audit?
If there hadn't been any representations made directly, I would say that we have a much more difficult case. Here you have estimates, you have representations.
Doesn't this statute assume that there has been information communicated and that it's misleading?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a I'm not sure that this absolves PERS necessarily when there is that direct communication. I mean, if they had no counselors, I understand what you're saying about the language of the statute. But I think when there is you have people coming in, acting in reliance, consistent with the Byrne case, and asking the question ultimately for the counselors who are having that communication not to say, or to say affirmatively, this is the minimum benefit.
Why doesn't this statute redirect liability to the city?
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to let the city off the hook. I agree.
It pretty seems to me, at least on the surface, says if it's inaccurate or misleading information coming from somebody else, that's not going to be excused.
And aren't you suggesting almost a fraud standard? I mean, in response to Justice Hardesty's questions, you're saying, well, yeah, the statute sort of does say that, and we're looking for some wiggle room. But what I heard you saying is that these employees, the PERS employees knew, they sort of hid the audit. Is that really where you're going with this?
Well, actually, I don't know. I think those individual counselors didn't hide the audit, because the evidence at trial was that one hand of PERS didn't know what the other was doing. So it's not directed at those individuals. It's directed at PERS as a whole. PERS is responsible for knowing what the other side is doing, knowing there's an audit. PERS, frankly, had at the very least imputed knowledge of the fact that there was the wrong formulas being applied by the city all along. They're PERS board members that work for the city, including Mr. Vincent.
Mr. Olson, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. I just want, when you get a chance, if you could get to the statutory cap issue and the damages, how they're calculated, and specifically on future damages, what your thoughts are about that as far as why you believe we should affirm those. And
I will do that, Your Honor. The damages, there's a complaint about the future damages. Future damages, the issue raised that there was no evidence, they say, of the life expectancy of the plaintiffs, and that they could, in fact, recover in excess of the cap amount. It's true that the life expectancy tables, for whatever reason, were not before the court at trial. The court did, however, have sufficient information to make a determination on its own about the potential for the plaintiffs to exceed the cap. You had the birth dates of the people, you had the people testifying, the court could assess the likelihood that they were going, the damages would exceed the cap. And we're talking about, I did the numbers, assuming, I think, that Mr. Fleischman had died, the very longest time period you would need to get to the cap would be 12 years. The court had enough information to assess that.
And did the court do a present value of that, or how was that done?
Well, Your Honor, there's no present value calculation in the record. I didn't see in the opposing briefs any cases cited which would require that. In this case, keep in mind that there's a COLA adjustment over time, so actually those amounts that were awarded aren't the full amounts. There is some adjustment for inflation that would be included, so there is, in a sense, a partial at least present value. But that's
the calculation. I'm sorry, did you finish your thought? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
But the calculation you're making is based upon what they would have received in their retirement based on the estimate as opposed to what they got. Is that the correct measure? Isn't the correct measure what they would have received had they changed their retirement date? And would that affect the amount?
Except that, Your Honor, they relied, to choose their retirement date, they relied on those existing numbers.
Well, I understand that, but and now I'm asking you about the correct measure of damages. If the theory is, I relied on incorrect information, maybe even misleading information, and as a result, I retired too soon, isn't the correct measure of damages, well, what would it have been if you had retired at the correct date?
Right.
And on some of these claimants, as indicated, it probably wouldn't have changed much.
Well, I think it's hard to know what the correct date would have been. How do you make that decision if you don't have the proper information? If you're referring to Mr. Brady.
But isn't that the contention of the claimants? I retired too soon because I got bad information.
That's correct, but until they knew, unless they had complete and accurate information, they couldn't be sure it would be speculative to say when that would have been. They don't know when they could have reached their peak dollar amount because they ended up retiring. They couldn't take that back. Once they retired, they were stuck. So the only way really to measure the damages is to measure what, you know, what they were promised. And I need to say that, you know, this happens. People get in this situation money that they're not, quote, entitled to according to the formula. I mean, think about the fact that there was an intention originally to go back and audit the firemen for the callbacks from 2004 to 2008. PERS and the city elected not to do that. Clearly, there were people that fell into the 2004-2007 time frame who got paid incorrectly for callbacks. PERS said, we're not going to look at that. They got that money. Mr. Vincent testified that he was aware of a couple of other instances where overpayments were allowed. There is deference shown to the beneficiaries by the state. You can also see that in the passage, whether it was retroactive or not, in 460 sub 7. By doing that, by passing that section, the state basically said, we're going to allow, when it's the city's fault or the employer's fault, we're going to allow those payments to be made, even though they're not technically correct. So there is a policy, I guess, of allowing these payments to be made, even though they're not correct according to the formula, because there's deference being shown to employees who have dedicated their careers to public safety in this instance.
The city argued this morning that the circumstances of each of the claimants is a little bit different. Do you agree with his characterization of Mr. Harper, Mr. Breen, Mr. Pulsifer, and I think Mr. Fleischman may actually be in a different circumstance?
Mr. Fleischman is in a slightly different circumstance. He did not sit across from the table from a counselor and receive the statement that you can make this much, you will get this much, and not less.
Was he also in a position where he could have delayed his retirement had he been aware that the calculation would have been less? That was my impression, and that's why I asked you the question about the damage calculation, right, as to him.
He could, well, he didn't know. By the time he made the decision, when he made the decision, he was under the impression that he was going to get paid X amount. I think it was $8,900. Mm-hmm. There is some reference in the briefs to the fact that the audit was public, or there was some news about the audit by the time he took his retirement. There's no evidence in the record that as to what he knew and whether that would have influenced his decision.
But was he disabled, so he was not able to go back and get a higher year minus the non-pensionable amounts improperly forwarded by the city?
He was not disabled, but by the time he...
One of them was, is that...
Mr. Breen.
I misspoke.
Yeah, Mr. Fleischman. By the time Mr. Fleischman found out, he'd already made his decision. He's the one who...
Okay.
They said...
What about Mr. Breen? I'm sorry to switch you, but then... If Mr. Breen, it would have been out of reach, so you're on a pure promissory estoppel with respect to him because he could never have generated a base year that would be higher through legitimate reporting by the city at that point, right?
I'm not sure if that's completely right. I know that's what was said. I do know it is correct that Mr. Breen was advised that he should take 14. He should take a period of disability to get up to his retirement. I'm not sure that he was completely unable to work. He was unable to do what he had been doing. I know that. So was he locked into a retirement at a certain... He could have decided differently, I think, with respect to the time he took, whether he would have taken all that leave. I think his reliance nonetheless was, and his expectation was nonetheless reasonable. And I'm just not sure, I'm sorry, about whether or not he was not working at all. My impression was that he wasn't working at the job he had been working as an engineer.
Yeah, I couldn't tell from the briefs. Thank you.
Mr. Olson, did you want to comment at all about the immunity issue and the statutory damage cap?
Yes. Immunity, I think I mentioned this. It is a discretionary act to call for the audit. I think that's pretty clear. It's not a discretionary act to choose not to disclose information that's material to these individuals. Particularly, it's not discretionary to tell them, in the case of at least two, that your benefits are going to be X, and only they'll go, and they'll go up from there. And that's, by the way, a natural expectation, because the way these are calculated, your benefits based on your highest 36 months of income. So if you work longer, the expectation is that your average income will go up. So from the client's perspective, our client's perspective, that made sense. And it's not, again, it's not a discretionary act to counsel people with false or incomplete information.
The cap.
With respect to the cap, the PERS has argued that there's one cap, I believe, $75,000. There's two separate claims on which damages have been awarded here, causes of action. There's a misrepresentation, negligent misrepresentation claim, as to which both defendants were found liable, and a fiduciary duty claim, as to which PERS was found liable. It's our position, I think it was the court's feeling, that there are two caps created by those, the existence of those two causes of action, allowing for the awards, the award of $75,000 twice in two caps. I do want to mention one other thing in the remaining time, and that is the retroactivity of the subsection 288.467. That is the section which, you know, says the liability is on the city. If you take a look at what happened when the amendment was passed to add that section, you know, the question, of course, is what's the intention? Is the intention to, by amending, is it to change the statute, to impose new law, or is it to clarify? The presumption is always that it's to change the law. However, if one takes a look at the events that took place, there was an acknowledgement by the city in the 2009 hearings, which considered the amendment, in which the city acknowledged that clearly, if it's determined the wages were erroneously reported due to an error or negligence by the city, clearly we should be responsible to the employee for the impact to the member's benefit. The city was acknowledging that obviously this is implicit in the statute. And when you have that sort of expectation that's simply being affirmed by the legislature, you can apply the law retroactively. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Aaron. Since I stepped on Mr. Wicker's time, I'd like to give him a minute of my 2 minutes to Mr. Wicker, and I'll
take it. Very kind of you.
I wanted to revisit the retroactivity. The city's statements have no impact whatsoever on legislative intent. The legislature has to clearly show they want to apply this retroactively. They didn't in this case. It can't be applied retroactively. As to the damages, there was almost no damage information at trial. All the judge was given was, we expected X, we got Y, give us something. That's no basis. They have an obligation to provide something to the judge to calculate their damages, and they didn't do it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Wicker.
Thank you, Your Honors. This case, if upheld, provides a very dangerous series of minefields for the PERS and the PERS Trust Fund, because this is not the Byrne case. This is the case of only in the case of two plaintiffs were allegations made that they said your benefits would not go down. But the PERS system is governed by statute as far as what the benefits are. And if an alleged comment by a counselor can change that whole benefit structure, that's a very big danger to the PERS system and the trust fund. And I would say the same thing is true of the audit. The audit was clearly a discretionary function, such as in the Foster case where the Washoe County...
Public information that an audit is underway?
Pardon?
Is it public record that an audit was underway?
Yes, every year the PERS decides which audits are going to do, and as the record said, there's 50 to 60 audits a year.
And it's public which ones are underway?
The public is presented to the board, and the board approves the audit schedule.
I'm sorry to disrail you.
And every aspect of the audit has to be discretionary. In this case, when you do the audit, who you audit, what issues do you audit, who
the other thing is that you needed to tell them, and that piece of it was not discretionary. That's their point.
Okay, and that piece of it they're talking about, they're focusing on the specific time when only three of them, Breen, Pulsifer, and Harper, were retiring, and they're saying PERS should have disclosed the existence of the audit. I would say that the evidence showed, contrary to what the court said, the only evidence of knowledge back in the 80s was Mr. Fleischman talked about an attorney general's opinion. That's the only evidence about the 80s. PERS testified that that problem in the 80s was fixed with a legislative and policy fix, and furthermore, Las Vegas was audited in 2004, and only one instance of callback problem was found, and that was in favor of the employee. In 2000, at the time this happened, there was one incident of one fireman where there was a problem with callback. That's certainly not enough to make it a material fact that puts this onerous obligation on PERS to disclose the audits when they're conducting this discretionary activity.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. And we thank all of you for your excellent presentations and the nice briefs. And so we will take this matter as submitted and take a short recess for the court to reconstitute and get the other parties up and running.